This podcast may contain language that's not appropriate for all listeners and a very exacerbated Corinne. Listener discretion is advised. Today we're going over...
You can do it.
White...
You can do it.
White Lotus, episode one.
Yay!
Yay, I got the color right and the flower right. So if you haven't seen it and don't want us to ruin it for you, you may want to pass on this one and we'll catch you next time.
Hey, gentle listeners.
Are you ready
for one dry kiss? Dropped right into a vase next to that white lotus. Welcome to One Dry Kiss, our cussy, irreverent love letter to rom-com movie/series. Although this is more of a dark comedy this week, because, you know, we like freshening it up and keeping things different. Mm-hmm. So I chose White Lotus, much to my co-podcaster's chagrin. Who's sitting in front of me? Corinne Edding.
I don't know if we would say chagrin, but I'm already highly suspicious. Highly suspicious. But I think this is good, like, Halloween-y themed, you know, action here. And I am here with... I must apologize now, Miss Tamara, because I am ride or die for you, but I will not, under any circumstances, be going to the fucking White Lotus Resort with you, Miss Tamara Cosio.
Why not? Why not?
Dude, I've only seen the first episode, and it is sketchy as hell up in there, okay? That's not including the first scene.
But if it was, like, all-inclusive, fully paid for.
No.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, fuck no. No. I am suspicious of a lot of different things right now, and I'm looking over my shoulder after I walk into every room because I'm like, there's a thing not right. My spotty senses are a-tingling. I am not okay with this. Yeah.
So. You are in danger, girl. You're in
danger, girl. Exactly. Exactly.
I sincerely hope some of our gentle listeners have seen White Lotus because it has a soft spot in my heart because I watched it and there's a season two that goes along with it. And I thoroughly enjoyed season one. It does have a lot of, like, what is happening moments. Mm-hmm. And so when season two came out, very excited, watched it, binged it over a weekend, I believe. And then I think a month or so later, it was Christmas, and I went to go visit my sister. And she's like, oh, I'm just about ready to sit down and watch White Lotus 2. And I was like, yes! So I sat down with her, and we binged it together. And it was, like, a lot of fun, because we were both, like, super into it. And be like, oh my god, what's happening? I'm like, I know, and I can't tell you. I know what's happening, and I can't say anything.
Well, I mean, I enjoyed the first episode. I just am not ever going to go to that place. But I enjoyed the first episode, and I am intentionally not watching ahead or anything like this because I have no idea about anything. So I am taking each episode as it comes. So you're getting fresh, unadulterated opinions and views. Yes.
Oh, goody. So I think we've got to modify our little end to be like, Corinne, what do you think's going to happen next?
Oh, gosh. Well, I would say after the... okay. I mean, I could hypothesize some things. All right. Mm-hmm. All right. Mm-hmm. I'm down. Let's do
okay.
it.
Okay. Good, good, good.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's
yeah.
like relationship rating doesn't really go too well with
no.
this. Yeah, no.
But. Although, I mean, interpersonal relationships, we could definitely, there's plenty to talk about in here, I gotta say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All bad. The relationships in here are problematic at best. I'm like, oh, God.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Ms. Tamara, I know the last time we recorded, we were talking about how we were going to parties. How was your party? Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh. So good. The party itself was good. I thoroughly enjoyed myself, except so it was Larry's cousin, who's like his sister's 30th anniversary, I believe. And so her sister threw her a surprise anniversary party at their friend's backyard, which was a beautiful house in Orange.
Nice.
And she had a swimming pool, which is normally fine, but they wanted Larry's son to come and everybody wanted to see the baby. So it was me watching the baby, like, make laps around the pool going, don't fall in, don't fall in, don't fall in, don't fall in, which was the majority of my evening. Just he had floaties on, but
yeah.
still like,
yeah.
And Larry was the one that would be like chasing after him because he was in grandpa mode.
Yeah.
But overall, it was a good party. I was just like, why did there have to be a pool that took up, like, you know, 75% of the yard?
Yeah. Yeah.
And they had those, like, you know, floating clear balls with the lights in it.
Oh,
and of course,
nice.
The baby wanted to go, like, ah, I want to touch that. Yeah. And it would reach over and I'd be like, dear God, no. But yeah, other than that, his two cousins, or his sister, I'm sorry, his sister that he hasn't seen for a really long time, and her husband wanted to go clubbing afterwards. And we did.
At what time? At what time was it? So it must have been like 10 in the evening, right?
I'm not. It was after. It was later than that. Yeah. I'm blocking it from my mind. I just remember getting to this club and being like, the only reason why I went was because it was 80s music.
Love 80s music.
I love 80s music. And once I got there, I'm like, no matter how much I love 80s music, I'm not 20 anymore. This is like, it's late. My feet hurt and I want to go home. And then I got like a sad surprise because right when we walked in, they weren't playing 80s music. They were playing Latin music. Oh. And I just looked at Larry because we were outside in the parking lot waiting for the other people to arrive. And so when we're in the parking lot, I'm like, this doesn't sound like anything I recognize from the 80s. It almost sounds like, I don't know, like a cumbia, cumbia music.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh no, I think it's, he tried to like, try to force some songs into the beat.
He's like, you know, Duran Duran has some real toe tappers there. They use accordion in Duran Duran, right?
Africa by Toto. Isn't that Africa by Toto? No, it's not. And so when we walked in, it was playing Latin music, and I just glared a hole through Larry's forehead. So I'm like, I told you so. If this is Latin music, I'm leaving right now. Not that I don't not like Latin music in certain points and times, but at 12:30 at night, after being at a house party for 6 hours, I'm like, I cannot. But it was a mashup, and somebody just threw in like some Latin jams, and then it like backed up into some 80s, some really obscure 80s songs. I almost wish I had a list. They played Supersonic by JJ Fad. That was one that they played.
S is for super, and then U is for unique, P is for perfection. Yes!
That's the one I remember, but some of the other ones, I was like, I have never heard this song before. And when they had like the video screens that showed the videos that corresponded with the song,
oh,
and I'm
nice.
Like, oh yeah, this is real low budge. This is real low budge. This wasn't on MTV, I'm sure of it. But still interesting. How was your party?
I didn't go because of social anxiety. And I was like, nope. That's not happening. I saw her the next day at church. I was like, hi, I'm sorry I didn't go to your party. And she's like, that's okay. It was a banger. There were lots of people there. And I was like, great. So, yeah. So it all worked out for the best.
Mm.
I was like, I'm surprised that you're here today. I mean, her party was like a sober party. So I didn't think that she'd be hungover. But still, like this party had different... Like, it wasn't just like, oh, we're all hanging out. It was like, first, there's these games, and then there's, like, a trivia, and then there's music, and then there's, like, yeah, I mean, there was just these stages to the party. Mm-hmm. And it was, like, 4+ hours long. And so I just was like, I'm surprised that she showed up the next day. And then she had to, like, get there, and then she had to, you know, help set things up and then take things down and stuff like that. So I was like, she may take a birthday date. But she didn't. She showed up. So yeah, that happened. I didn't go. Thanks, social anxiety.
They had a taco man at my party. They had a guy in the corner making delicious tacos.
Ooh.
But to stay in theme with the party, since I was like, oh, they have an open bar and they have tacos. And they had like 5 signature drinks that they had created for the occasion. And I was like, oh, I'll have the tequila one because that sounds like a tasty drink. And I'll drink tequila and I'll eat tacos. And then come midnight, 12:30, my stomach was like,
Tamara, you have regrets.
You have heartburn.
Yes. I am a fiery furnace.
And Larry's sister bought me a drink and I couldn't even finish it. I'm like, my throat is on fire and I don't want to be rude. So I'm just going to accidentally leave it in the bathroom. So
throw it over your shoulder. You know, it all works out.
Oh, yeah. hit the people behind me. I felt really bad. Like, I would like to go back to that club at some point in time, much, much earlier in the evening.
Yes, yes.
100%. I think that would be cool. Yeah.
Yeah, it's one thing to, like, stay out at a club until 1, 2 in the morning when you're, like, you got there around 10 and you're, like, you're enjoying yourself. Mm-hmm. And, your feet, they got to moving and your booty's got to popping and stuff like that. But when it's, like, oh, I just
location.
Yeah, all day at an outdoor pool party and it's midnight and now, hey, let's go to a club. No. After midnight, for the second location, it's where you go to the quiet place to, like, just hang out and chill and drink beers together and talk.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. And the bane of my evening, too, was that, like I said, I've gotten to know Larry's two cousins who are like his sisters because they grew up together.
Yeah.
And I don't get to spend, like, a lot of one-on-one time with them. And so one of his cousins, Kelly, came. It was Kelly's party. And she came over. And she was kind of tipsy. And she was like, you know why I love you, Tamara? And I'm like, no, why? And Kelly's mom was right there, Tat. Aunt Tat was right there. And Aunt Tat was tipsy, too. And she's like, why do you love Tamara? And I'm like, ouch. Hey, now. And she goes, no, I know why I love you. I just want to know why she loves you. And Kelly was like, well, I'm going to tell you right now. And then Larry's real sister, Shauna, who is also tipsy, jumped into the mix and cut him off about something completely irrelevant. And I was like, wait, I still haven't found out why Kelly loves me. Kelly said she loves me. And I never found out why. And I'm sure she probably wouldn't remember if I bring it up now.
She should be able to tell you why she loves you, though, regardless of the drunkenness.
Oh, I'm sure. But I don't want to be like, so Kelly, why do you love me? And she'll be like, I'm sorry, what? But speaking of party, yes. Shall we get this party started, Corinne, with a synopsis?
Okay. I got one for you. Well, it's more like a character rundown. But yes, I have a synopsis.
Okay, lay it on me.
Synopsis. White Lotus Episode 1.
Called The Arrivals.
It's called what?
The Arrivals.
The Arrivals. Yes, because they are arriving. Done. Synopsis done. Mm-hmm. They arrived.
Mm-hmm. The end.
The end. No. Okay. I've got more, though. First sentence. Don't stay at the White Lotus Hotel. There is something very off about the place. And I'm not saying that knowing anything about the series. I'm saying it from the first episode. We meet three members of the hotel staff. Armand, played by Murray Bartlett, who is the head of the hotel and espouses being friendly but vague with hotel guests. Lonnie, played by Jolene Purdy. She's on her first day of work and is struggling. And Belinda, played by Natasha Rothwell. She's in charge of the spa. And I don't know what her deal is, but she lies to one of the guests.
I'm just saying this all.
Mm-hmm. Oh?
Mm-hmm. And now we get to the guests. Newlyweds. Rachel, played by Alexandra Daddario, and Shane, played by Jake Lacey. Shane is a big dick. I'm not saying he has a big dick. I have no idea the size, but he is a big dick. And Rachel, well, she may just have an ulterior motive for being there. My spidey sense is tingling around that. I'm just saying is all. Then we have the Mossbacher family. Mom Nicole, played by Connie Britton, and Dad Mark, played by Steve Zahn. Nicole is apparently some kind of wealthy famous lady, and Mark, the husband, is going through a bit of a hypochondriac moment because he's close to the age that his dad died at. Their son, Quinn, played by Fred Heschinger, is a teenager and really just wants to be left alone to play video games. And their teenage daughter, Olivia, played by Sydney Sweeney, has brought her friend Paula, played by Brittany O'Grady. I call them the Diva Twins because they are kind of horrible, snobby teenagers.
Yes.
And the final guest, Tanya, played by Jennifer Coolidge. The glorious Jennifer Coolidge. Who seems like a lonely, hot mess of a human being. And if I met her in real life after about 5 to 10 minutes, I would know, okay, I'm going to avoid this person because they are going to suck the life energy out of me. And with those brief character bios, and once again, my warning, don't stay at the White Lotus Hotel. I think we're ready to launch into episode 1.
And Corinne doesn't know what's happening, so she's just going on a hunch.
Yes.
She's going on a hunch that she shouldn't stay there after the first episode.
Oh, we'll get into it. We're going to get into it. I have comments. I was a tippy and tapping away there. I have interruptions. Sorry, Tam. I'm just spoiling it. I'm interrupting you in a few places because I just like, oh my, OMGs. I got that.
Putting her hands to her head feelings. Like it's exploding.
Yes.
Well, first, can we talk about the opening scene, like the reoccurring opening credits? It's kind of interesting because it shows what I imagine is the wallpaper of the like hotel rooms.
Okay.
So it's got like very intricate patterns. And at first they seem very benign, but then as they go from like wallpaper pattern to wallpaper pattern, they get a little phallic.
Oh, they get phallic. Oh, nice.
Yes. There's some that look like, oh, that looks like a vagina. And oh, that, you know, the vagina was right next to a sepal of a flower. And it almost looks like phallic. And then after you get the, well, that's what I interpreted it to be. And then they get a little like sinister. And then the images get slightly sinister and so on and so forth. So
I did not notice that. Now I'm feeling like there's like a balls and penis and vajay theme throughout this show as well. We'll see.
All right. And so now that we've thoroughly discussed the decor of the White Lotus walls, let's jump into it.
Woohoo!
Imagine an opulent resort on a tiny isolated island in Hawaii. That's the White Lotus, or Purple Chrysanthemum, or Peach Lily, if you're asking Corinne, where the upper crust go to vacation. There is a trained, attentive staff there to serve their guests every need, and almost every section of the resort has a beach view. It's that kind of place. Mm. But we don't begin there. We begin at the departure gate of a small airport where a 30-something man is sitting by himself, staring intently at the floor. An older couple sits across from him, and the woman decides to try to make some friendly conversation. She asks if he's headed home, and the young man barely utters a, yeah. She takes this as a sign that he's game to chat and continues, "We were at the Armani. It was nice. The food was good, but not much to do. Where were you staying?" Her husband, who was previously reading a newspaper, is now curious about the young man and looks up as the man mutters, the White Lotus. A flash of recognition crosses the woman's face as she states, "The White Lotus! Our guide told us that somebody died there." The young man says matter-of-factly, "Yeah, they're loading the body onto the plane right now." The older woman eyes the plane parked on the tarmac and asks, "On our plane? To Honolulu?" The man confirms this, and the woman, undeterred, says, "Well, besides that, how was your vacation?"
Read the room! Read the room!
The young man's face tightens as he says, "It wasn't a vacation, it was my honeymoon." The older couple congratulate him and ask cheerily, "Well, where's your wife?" The man rolls his eyes and puts his sunglasses on before telling them, "No offense, but can you please leave me the fuck alone?" Mm. Before standing up and walking towards the airport window, where he watches two baggage claim handlers loading a cardboard box with a sign on it that says, "Human Remains."
Oh. And I'm thinking he should have said, "Where's my wife? On the plane right now." and also... That couple is so fucking tone deaf. I am like, the man obviously doesn't want to talk, and that woman just keeps on going.
And I would be like, oh shit, you were at the resort where somebody died. So how else was the resort besides the dead bodies floating around? Was it good? Was the food good?
Oh, I mean, I would have asked what happened. I was like, so what happened?
Oh, but that's you, Corinne. That is totally you. That is the person who... After their best friend cheats on their other best friend, would like walk out in solidarity, but then be like, "Call me and tell me what happened." A la Four Weddings and a Funeral, the last episode.
Truth, truth. Then we flash back 1 week earlier, where a private ferry shuttles a small group of people across the ocean towards a small island. On the boat are a family of five, two adults, the wife played by Connie Britton, and the husband played by Steve Zahn. And if I'd known that Steve Zahn was in this, I would have watched it when it came out. Thanks for holding out on me, Tam. Thanks a lot.
No problem. You didn't see my big bulletin at the very top of my notes. It says, make sure you tell Corinne that Steve Zahn's in this.
And the three teenagers who are with them. An attractive older woman, Jennifer Coolidge, and a young couple, one of which is the surly man from the airport who has an attractive young woman draped around his shoulders as they take selfie photos with the ocean behind them. Two of the teens from the family are 16-year-old young ladies named Olivia and Paula, who are visibly bored now and clearly not related. They stand on the upper deck and play the game, where they fabricate stories for their fellow passengers. For the young couple, Olivia says, "Those two just got married in the Hamptons. Her parents own the place there." Paula adds, "And I bet they met on Raya." The two teens continue to tag team details for their joined story. Paula, "He went to Dartmouth for international finance." Olivia, "She loves him." Paula, "But he has a small dick." Olivia snickers and adds, "And he's a closet Adderall snorter." Paula, "It gives him an edge at work." Olivia, "Which makes his dick even smaller. And gentle listeners, we all know there's nothing I, Corinne, loves more than small dick jokes." That's sarcasm. Or as I spelt it, sarcasm.
Which is worse than sarcasm.
The teens do the same thing for Jennifer Coolidge, guessing that she's a Walmart heiress who is meeting her friends that don't really like her, but she pays for everything so she's tolerated, which I don't think they're that far off on the friends who don't really like her, but she pays for everything so she's tolerated line of things. Mm-hmm. And finally, they get to the other two adults on the boat and state flatly, "High-end pimps for a billionaire sex pervert. They're coming to recruit us for their Illuminati pedophile sex ring." The girls chuckle as the woman calls out cheerfully, "Hey, girls!" Olivia snarks, "What, Mom?" The woman waves towards the front of the boat. "Come to the other side, Liv. I think you can see the resort. We're almost there."
And they are. And on the shore, ready to greet them, are five White Lotus employees that have huge grins plastered on their face as they wave enthusiastically at the approaching boat. One of the employees' waves is a little less enthusiastic, and the pink-suited man, who's giving serious John Cleese vibes,
yes,
next to her directs, "Wave big, Alani!" The boat lands, and the employees position themselves to greet their guests. We find out that the pink-suited man is named Armand, and the unenthusiastic waver is Lonnie. It's her first day, and she's getting trained. Armand informs the new hire that, "These are VIPs, and they're very much into non-disclosure, and we are to serve them as a presence, not so much as an identity. You want to be generic, like pleasant, interchangeable, helpers, or tropical kabuki. The guests get a satisfying sense of vagueness, where we provide everything they want, even though they don't know what they want, or where they are, or who they are, or what the fuck is even going on." Lonnie smiles noncommittally and holds up a platter of warm towels for the approaching guests. Armand has been fully prepped on all the VIP guests and greets them by name. The parents of the 16 surly-year-old teens are the Mossbachers, and they are staying in the Tradewinds suite. The newlywed couple are Mr. Shane Patton and Mrs. Rachel Patton, and they're staying in the Palm suite. And lastly, there's Miss Tanya McQuad, Jennifer Coolidge, who I just will say, Jennifer Coolidge, every time she comes on screen because I love her, who's staying in the Hibiscus suite. The arrivals all make small talk at their reception, except Miss McQuad, who just needs a massage, like, now. Belinda, the spa manager who's present, checks her schedule and sadly relays that there's nothing available that day.
But does she check her schedule? She's just looking at a piece of paper. It's unlikely that she has the full schedule on that. And I think she's got a paper full of lies. But I have receipts to back that up later, so carry on.
Okay. Well, she probably, like you, can sense Tanya's neediness and is just like, "Oh, no, I'm not getting into that today. Nope, I'm absolutely not." Miss McQuad practically pleads she'll take anything except Reiki. And to placate her and move her along, Armand and Belinda assure her that they'll see what they can do.
Inside the Palm Suite, the newlywed Pattons are eager to get their honeymoon started. It's time to do the bed dance. They begin making out on the bed when Shane looks around and says, wait a second. We're in the wrong room. He begins exploring the space, which has a huge separate living area, a dining table that can seat 8, and 2 patios. Rachel follows after him, chuckling, "What do you mean this is the swankiest hotel I've ever stayed at?" Shane explains dismissively, "Well, that's because you haven't traveled much. We're supposed to have the honeymoon suite." "What the fuck? Oh, honey, that's just because you haven't traveled. Fuck off."
"Yes, let me pat you on the head and tell you how the world works."
"You plebe." Shane says, "This room is not what we paid for. And I'm really hoping it was Rachel in that body bag being loaded onto the airplane, because he's already proved himself to be a massive dick, as opposed to the tiny dick the teens postulated. And Rachel would either be in for a lifetime of misery with him, or super messy vindictive divorce. Or maybe she just like secreted herself away when she realized that she had accidentally married like the biggest asshole, and it's not actually her in the thing going on to the airplane." Yeah, the body crate.
Coffin? Mm-hmm. The cardboard coffin.
Yes, the cardboard coffin. Because we don't actually know who is on there.
We only know it's human remains.
Yes. Rachel, a little wounded, subtly reminds him, "Well, technically, neither did you pay for the room. Your parents paid for this." She points out all the wonderful amenities that they do have, but Shane is undeterred because they were supposed to have their own plunge pool and a private patio. And seriously, who can vacation without their own plunge pool and private patio? I mean, I personally would be super bummed, because I see those private plunge pools on the vacations on Love is Blind, and I'm going to try and make this dream reality. Regardless, the baby man way that Shane acts has Rachel assuring him that it's not a big deal. But Shane is like a dog after a bone. He wants everything to be perfect for their honeymoon. And the number one tip on making things perfect for a honeymoon is acting disgruntled and throwing a fit. Hashtag pro tip.
That's definitely one of my turn-ons.
Uh-huh. Yeah. If you're with somebody who's just like, "This isn't the way that things are supposed to be, and I don't think that this is right either, and I'm just not going to be paying for any of this." You're like, "That's so romantic, honey."
Oh, my juices are circulating right now.
It's bed dance time. It's bed dance time. Yes. She kisses him and murmurs that he's the sweetest and he seems placated, but when they break apart, he abruptly says, "I'm going to go talk to the guy, but how about a blowjob real quick first?"
God damn it.
Yeah. Rachel playfully slaps his chest, but turns him down, causing him to protest. "We just got off a 12-hour flight. You really want me to go talk to this guy with half a chub?" When Rachel makes no move, he finally relents. "You're right. Save it for the right room." A.K.A. the room with the plunge pool and the private balcony and whatnot. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He turns to leave and Rachel follows, saying, "Hang on, I'll go with you."
She wants to be the buffer. She wants to be the buffer because she knows he's a prick.
Yeah, exactly. Which, okay. And I don't mind him being like, "Oh my gosh, I think we're in the wrong room. Right. I want to try and rectify the situation." That's not a problem. How he's acting like a baby man is the problem. Mm-hmm. And I have to also say that Shane kind of mumbles when he talks. So I'm glad that Tamara caught that line about the blowjob, because I didn't catch it at all. And I thought you had made up the line.
No, I did not.
And I went back and watched the end of that scene over again, because I was like,
yeah,
no way he said that. That's something that I would make up that he said 100%. Yeah. But that's not something he would say.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, he did. He did.
Yeah. And I was like, triggered. That's why I was like, ah, I got to include this just to showcase what a douchebag he is.
Uh-huh. Yeah. At the Hibiscus Suite, Miss Tanya McQuad?
She says quad. It's like quad. It's only got one syllable. Quad. Actually, two. Because it's McQuad.
Okay.
She says at the beginning of the movie.
Perfect. Thank you. McQuad has been dropped off, and Lonnie asks if she needs anything else. Tanya asks, "My luggage, where is it?" Lonnie brightly offers, "Right behind you," because behind Tanya, no more than a foot away, is a mound of matching beige luggage. Tanya glances at it and says more frantically, And gentle listeners, I must apologize because Tamara has the perfect McQuad voice and I do not. I might work on it though, because we're going to be in this for a while. So I may try and wrestle something up, but it wasn't going to be episode one. Tanya glances at it and says more frantically, "No, there was a small white plastic bag. I really need it. My mother's ashes were in it." This spurs Lonnie to start rifling through the room while Tanya starts retracing the trip. "I mean, there were two boats. Can you call the boats to come back? And then there was a golf cart thingy, but there was no trunk, so..." Just then, Lonnie produces a white garbage bag from behind the suitcases and Tanya gasps, "Oh, thank you. That's it. Oh my God, I couldn't lose this. That would be really bad." Lonnie hands her the bag and Tanya tips her. Lonnie seems slightly uncomfortable as she says, "Mahalo," and hurries out of the room. Lonnie is a fuller-figured gal, but when she gets into the hallway, she cups her stomach in discomfort and hisses, "Oh my God." And we realize she's pregnant. Well, at least Tam did. I didn't realize she was pregnant until a bit later because apparently I'm clueless.
I was tripping out when I first watched that, because when she's like, "Oh, it's a white bag," and I expected it to be like a little cute satchel.
Uh-huh.
"Oh, it's got my mother's ashes in it." Still was expecting a cute white satchel. And then when she produces like this Hugh Gumbus garbage bag, it's got something really clunky and big in it that looked almost like body parts. I was like, exactly what parts of your mother are in there? But it was just like a huge box that apparently held her ashes. But for a few minutes there, I was very nervous. And then was like, "You keep your mother's ashes in a garbage bag? Okay."
"Oh, my sister's in the Ziploc. So there you go."
I knew, but look at her, like, opulent luggage.
Yes.
And all the she bags that she has and how she presents herself, and yet her mom's in a garbage bag.
Oh, yeah. No. If I were living that kind of a life, I would have the cutest urn, even if I was going to be scattering shit from it. For my sister, maybe it'd be like a little gnome, and, like, the gnome would just be filled with ashes and then the little top hat, you know.
When they blow out the top of the
exactly
nose,
yeah,
it'd be pressurized air just like blow Bridget all over the world,
because we have money for that kind of thing. Absolutely. And it would have a special carrying case, and that carrying case would be in a super cute piece of luggage, and the luggage would be hand-stitched leather or something like that. Something my sister would really approve of. I'm just saying, mm-hmm. You know. Yeah,
because you know what the best way, or what is the best way to lose ashes, is to put them in a garbage bag so people might come across it and think it's garbage and therefore throw it away.
That's how I find all the best ashes, okay, Tam?
Mm.
Yeah.
Pro travel tip. Yeah. Yes. Pro travel tip. Inside the Tradewind suite, the surly teens, Olivia and Paula, are soaking in the glorious view from their balcony several floors up. Mom Mossbacher interrupts and asks the girls, "Please declutter the common space or else you'll give me an anxiety attack." The suite is as opulent as the Palm Suite where the Suttons are staying. The common area has a pull-out couch, and that seems to be where the teens are staying. There are a few open suitcases scattered about, but it's far from cluttered. Mom rushes about. "Maybe we can find a place to store these things." She opens a random door to find a small galley kitchen and her 14-year-old son sitting on a cot scrolling on his phone. She asks incredulously, "Quinn, what are you doing in there?" And he sheepishly responds, "Olivia said I had to sleep in here." Mom cries, "Olivia, you can't stick your brother in this tiny airless room. We have this huge space and you got to bring a friend." Olivia coolly assures her mom that her little brother will be fine and the move was necessary or else they'd wake up to find him jacking off to Paula.
Mm.
To which Paula responds flatly, "And I don't want to wake up to that, Miss Mossbacher." Mom smiles tightly and says, "Call me Nicole." So Paula adds, "And I'm so appreciative, Nicole." Quinn assures his mom from the other room by yelling, "I'm fine here." And Olivia declares, "See, he'll be fine. He's fapping or gaming or whatever," before hustling out the door with her bestie. Nicole heads to her private room, but not before assuring her son, "We'll fix this shortly," but makes no move to change his sleeping situation and closes her master suite's doors behind her.
And I personally would rather be in that cozy little nook and have some privacy than have to deal with the Diva twins.
Yes.
That's just me.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I feel bad. The mom's like, yeah, we'll get you out of here eventually, but not right now. And I don't want to be around the Diva twins either. I'm closing the door.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Meanwhile, in the employee locker room, Lonnie is about to take off her shirt because earlier Armand had pointed out that she got some kind of white and globby food on it.
It looked like bird poo to me, honestly.
Yuck. Lonnie cheerily informs her, I got something on my shirt, but waits until she is alone before removing it. And when she does, we see her noticeable baby bump.
Still didn't notice it.
I didn't notice it either. I just know that she is eventually, spoiler. So I think I probably could have hid my hand a little bit more with this, but I was like, she's pregnant. I was going to say it. She's pregnant. So I don't have to write in the intrigue. She gets on a clean shirt when her phone rings and it's her boyfriend, Daryl. Lonnie answers it and is in panic mode. She tells him, I think the baby's coming. It hurts so bad.
That's when I figured out she was pregnant.
Daryl tells her to just come home, but Lonnie rejects this. I can't. Because it's my first day. They don't even know I'm pregnant, and I only got 4 more hours. I can make it. Daryl stops protesting and says he'll pray for her, and he's there for her before she hangs up. Lonnie has put on a mustard yellow uniform dress and makes her way back to Armand, who's glad to see she's changed before asking, are you a messy eater? Because this is beach casual, but always clean and presentable.
Oh, gross.
Lonnie looks as she's about to pass out, but manages a nod and repeats, clean.
That line was such like a gross manager thing to say. As like, fuck yes. Right off. Seriously?
And he keeps bringing it up. Like, she had something gloppy on her shirt. And he's like, do you eat messy? Like, does that happen to you a lot? Like, do you always have shit on your shirt? I'm like, fuck off, Armand. Like, Jesus Christ. Because, yes, I do.
Just to entice you, Armand. Just to entice you. Want a snack?
As I stated before, my old coworker David would always be like, hey, do you want to go have lunch or have you already eaten? And he'd look at my shirt and be like, nope, you don't have anything on you. You obviously haven't eaten yet. I'm like, fuck you, David.
David! No. Just then, they are approached by the newlywed Suttons. Armand greets them warmly and asks them if everything to your liking. Shane informs him that they have the wrong room, that they should have been in the honeymoon suite. Armand says matter-of-factly, there's no honeymoon suite. Shane struggles to maintain his composure and adds, it had a plunge pool and a private patio. Armand clickety-clacks on his keyboard as he explains, that's the pineapple suite, but you have a very nice presidential room, the palm suite with an ocean view. Rachel, who's been standing by with a smile plastered on her face, agrees. It's a very nice room, but Shane is undeterred. My mom booked the room and showed me the virtual tour that has a private plunge pool. Maybe I should call her. Armand's polite facade cracks ever so slightly as he says, Armand, how did he fucking get his job? Because, like, okay, so he says, no, that's the pineapple suite. You have this other suite. And then he doesn't, like, look into it any further or anything like that. And then when Shane's like, I'm going to call my mom, he's like, oh, what you going to do about it? Huh? I mean, he doesn't say it that way. But, like, and he should have said, unfortunately, the pineapple suite is reserved, so I can't do anything to get you into that room. That's what he should have said, just right away. And I also wonder if the pineapple suite is a swingers suite, because pineapple is the symbol for swingers. So that's just a, I don't know.
Oh.
Little side note. But it also is a sign of hospitality in Hawaiian culture. So there's that as well. So.
And that was a dip into Corinne's managerial handbook.
Armand's polite facade cracks ever so slightly as he says, oh, yes, call her and what's she going to say? Besides, the pineapple suite is unavailable. There's a newlywed couple from Germany staying in it. Shane squints and reiterates sharply, but it's not a honeymoon suite? After a few more back and forth where Armand repeats that he's in a very nice room, fuck right off with that. But your room is really nice, even though it's not the one that you reserved. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a nice room. We're not confused about that. It just doesn't have the plunge pool that Corinne requires.
And we'll never know because we're never staying at the White Lotus, according to Corinne.
Oh, correct. We will not be. But there are other places where we can go for our own private plunge pool. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Yes. I've been following Love is Blind. I have seen several of them. I have tried writing down the resort names and looking up the rooms to see how much they cost. Shane emphasizes, well, you better not be charging me for the pineapple suite. And they realize they're at an impasse. And I agree with Shane that he shouldn't be charged for the more expensive room. And that should be easy enough to remedy. And if this manager were worth a lick of salt, he would look at the rates that they're paying and be like, hey, you're all good. Or, oh my gosh, you were accidentally overcharged. I'm going to reimburse X amount of dollars to your account. But he does none of that.
He doesn't.
Once they're gone, Armand turns to Lonnie and says, shit, I think I fucked up and double booked the pineapple suite. But in situations like that, it's important to stay positive. You have to treat these people like sensitive children. They just want to be seen. The special only baby child of the resort, and we're their mean mummies denying them their pineapple room. Lonnie is nodding politely, taking all of this in, but there's a tightness behind her face, like she's really holding back on something. Is it a big fart? Find out after the break. Just kidding.
I wonder slightly if Armand is like being hardlined about the stupid room situation because he's training Lonnie and doesn't want to be like, yeah, you don't just give these people fucking anything they want. Like, you have to try to put a line in the sand, and then if they keep pushing and pushing and pushing it, then you let them cross over and you give them something. But you want to like hold them at bay for a little while to see if you can just placate them with vagueness and reiterations of things that are true. Like, did I tell you you have a very nice room?
You know what? That sounds like your boss man.
I know. I've dealt with managers like this before. Anyways, back in the Tradewind suite, we are treated to a close-up of Mark Mossbacher's hairy ball sack that he picks up and down as his wife examines it. I don't want to rest on this visual. I did not enjoy seeing his ball sack, but Corinne didn't mind it at all.
I'd like to correct you, Tim.
What?
I rewound and paused. And he's a shaver. His ball sack is kind of like those bowling balls you use to work around, not in size, but in shininess. And I'm wondering if he has a buff rag for it like the bowlers do for their balls.
Oh.
These are the thoughts that keep me up at night.
God. Okay. Sorry. His non-hairy ball sack, then.
Perfect. Perfection.
Mark's hell-bent that his balls are enlarged, and it's cancer. For sure, cancer. Nicole tries talking him off the ledge because they're going to hear from their doctor the very next day, and it could be a lot of things. Mark hisses. Like what? A family of mice that crawled up in there and made a nest? It's cancer! He says this last bit loudly, and Nicole shushes him because the kids are in the next room. She hisses back. What makes you so sure? Mark reminds her that his father died very young of cancer, and Nicole asks, testicular? He hesitates and realizes that he doesn't know, but he's hell-bent on finding out. He'll call his uncle. He'll know. Nicole continues assuring him that if it's cancer, they'll deal with it. They've made huge advances in medicine since his father's days. She's finally tired of his catastrophizing and encourages him to take his son out. She motions to the closed door and urges, he looks like he's sitting in a dentist office waiting to get a root canal. Can you please take him somewhere fun? Mark relents. If he is going to die, he might as well make some lasting memories at the resort with his son. He collects Quinn from his kitchen closet room and leads him out to the balcony so they can drink in the view. Quinn stares at his father blankly when he asks if he'd like to go find some adventure. Quinn would rather sit in his airless room on his phone, but Dad won't take no for an answer, and they head down to the lobby to talk to Armand.
And I think it's no wonder that he's freaking out. His son is the same age that he was when his dad died. So,
yeah,
he's at a very emotionally fragile part, I think, in his life experience right at this moment in time.
Yes, agreed. And I'm like that normally. And my parents died of alcohol related issues. And I'm just like, what is that? Oh, my God. Am I having a heart attack? Although my aunt did die very young of a heart attack. So,
yeah. Whenever I go to see my GP, I'm like, okay, just let me know if I'm dying or not. Here's the things that are going on with me. And then I also do that to my boss man. I'm like, does this mean I'm dying? And he's like, you're fine. Just since I ask, then I don't dwell on it because then they give me the answers that I want. And so then, you know, I just make another list for the next time I see them.
Good.
Yeah.
Good on you.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Tanya has made her way to the Very Zen Resort Spa to see if Belinda has made good on her attempt to squeeze her in. She's disappointed to find out that although Belinda remembers her, they cannot accommodate her that day for a massage. However, Belinda offers her a consultation to get a better idea of what's going on with Tanya's body and some cranial sacral. Tanya practically whimpers, "But no massage?" Belinda assures her, "I'm sure you'll find it very cathartic." And I'm wondering if there are even any massage therapists or anyone around besides Belinda, because the waiting room practically has a tumbleweed rolling through it. There is nary a person inside aside from the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
She reluctantly agrees, Tanya does, as long as she doesn't have to get naked. Tanya dons a robe, and we next see the two in a dim room sitting on mats on the floor. Belinda has heard that her spa patron is very tired and is trying to get to the root of her exhaustion. After some light questioning, Tanya finally admits, "Well, my mom just passed away in June, and dealing with all the logistics is exhausting, and I have her ashes, and I brought them here, and I was going to scatter them in the ocean because she loved the ocean." Belinda's eyes shine with tears as she shares that her mother passed away recently, too, and she's still dealing with the loss. But Tanya glosses past this and starts talking about her love life and how it's fucked and how she drives men away because she gets too attached, which makes her feel empty. She is a black hole of emotional void. Yes, she is empty. She's a big
bottle of suck sauce.
Yes. Poor Tanya. It's difficult being Tanya. I completely agree. Belinda nods sympathetically and asks Tanya to lay down while she massages her neck. That's the cranial sacral part. She asks Tanya to repeat positive affirmations such as, "Feel the newness of each moment. I am my own phallic mother and my own vaginal father." Much like the wallpaper, "I fill my own cup." After Tanya repeats all the bananas of things, but does at least put a question mark on the end of, "I am my own vaginal father," Belinda begins chanting in Sanskrit over her, and Tanya mimics her. Belinda whispers, "You don't have to do this part." But Tanya smiles back at her and says, "I know, but I like it." She remains quiet, and as Belinda continues chanting, Tanya seems to have an awakening of sorts. A vision, if you will.
Down by the commoner pool, Rachel has donned her sexy, not sexy, pool gear.
Unlike the private plunge pool.
Yes. Which consists of a long-sleeved, semi-sheer polka-dot shirt and bright blue and red floral shorts. She sees Paula and Olivia and sits a short distance away from them on a pool lounger. She seems to be working up the courage to talk to these two teens who are engrossed in their light beach read books by Nietzsche and Sigmund Freud.
Oh.
And she finally calls out cheerily, "Hi, I saw you on the plane and the boat earlier." The teens seem uninterested in friendly chit-chat, but then realize that this is their chance to find out how close their boat guesses were about the newlyweds. Olivia drops her book slightly and asks, "Where are you from?" Rachel tells them, "New York, East Village, but I'm letting go of my place to move in with my husband, whose name is Shane." Paula smiles slyly and asks, "Where did you meet him?" Rachel replies, "Through friends." And Olivia practically smirks, "Not on Raya?" Rachel confirms, "No, not on Raya. We met through friends last September." This seems to interest the girls, and they put their books down further and pepper her with additional questions. "Wow, that was fast. How did you know he was the one?" Rachel seems slightly less sure of her response as she says, "Oh, I don't know. The chemistry was there, and Shane wanted to get married, and he's very decisive." Olivia mutters to her friend so Rachel doesn't hear, "His dick is definitely not small." And the awkward small talk continues. We learn that Rachel's a journalist and Shane's family's wealthy. And you really wonder why Rachel's subjecting herself to these girls' scrutiny and thinly veiled contempt when she finally asks, "So your mom looks really familiar. What does she do?" Paula answers on behalf of Olivia and says proudly, "Her mom is the CFO of Poof." Rachel feigns surprise. "Oh, yeah, Nicole Mosbacher.
Oh, yeah.
I actually wrote a profile on her. 10 women who are kicking the corporate world's ass." The mom talk seems to bore the girls, and they pick up their books and snicker quietly to each other as Rachel calls out, "Well, nice meeting you," as she gets in the pool. But her disrobing has caught the girls' attention again, and they gawk at her Victoria's Secret model figure as she dives into the pool.
Mm-hmm. First, they're like, oh, that frumpy little bitch. And then when they see that she is like, ah, they're like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
The diva twins got a little like sour look on their face with that. But I don't think what they didn't pick up on was that Rachel's like, oh, who are you? Oh, yeah. Immediately, I'm going to say your mom's full name and say, oh, yeah, I just happened to do a profile on her that I cribbed from another profile on her. But still, yeah, really, I have no idea who she is, but that's totally cool.
Yeah. Totally not subtle. Totally not subtle. Mm-hmm. Totally.
Also, the diva twins threw some shade at her because the woman's like, yeah, I moved to New York to pay off my school loans. And I was like, I think that's a terrible place to try and pay off your school loans, like New York City. But whatever. And the diva twins are like, well, I'm pretty sure Shane can pay off your school loans. And they like look at each other. All three of them are like back and forth. She pauses and she's like, yeah, he could. And I'm like, oh, really? Oh, you don't say.
Yeah. Yeah.
A little while later, we see Lonnie hobbling around the lobby in noticeable discomfort. She takes a moment to lean on the far side of the front desk when we hear a what do we hear? Is it the fart I suggested earlier during the fake break? Find out with us after this very real break. And we're back, and we wonder, what would be the oddest possible noise to hear at this moment in time? Tamara, thoughts?
I really like the fart idea. I really do. That would be, like, awesome if she was like, and then all of a sudden she's like, oh, my stomach doesn't hurt anymore.
Oh, it was just gas. It was just gas.
Miraculously, I'm fine now.
Well, sadly, it's not just gas. We hear a sploosh and a splat. And that's not any kind of baby falling out of her vajay, but it is her water breaking. No one sees it, and she sits there momentarily shocked before Amon notices her from the other side of, like, the pony wall that she's leaning against. And says, Lonnie, you look as wet as a sheet. Are you feeling okay? Was it food poisoning from tuna or whatever it was on your shirt?
Armand, leave the fucking shirt alone.
I know.
Leave the fucking food on the shirt alone.
Passive-aggressive bullshit. Passive-aggressive bullshit. You have already communicated to me that it is not okay for me to have a big glop of something on my shirt. Duh. I think I could figure that out. Thank you. It was a snack for later, okay? Mm-hmm. Sometimes I get peckish. Lonnie stammers, I should sit down. Armand advises her, you can't sit down in front of the guests, but please take a rest in my office. She nods slightly and shuffles off. Just then, he's approached by Mark and Quinn Mossbacher, who are on the hunt for some adventures and want Armand to point them in the right direction, which he does not initially. Mark proposes scuba diving and asks the hotel manager if that's available. Armand cheerily tells them it is, but they'll need their paddy license. Mark's blank stares spurs Armand to explain, you can get one here on site in our pool, but it'll take 3 days. And if Armand was any good at his job, he'd follow up with the scuba ask by saying, snorkeling is very popular around here. You could give that a try. But he doesn't. And 3 days is too long to wait. So Mark proposes, what about water skiing? Armand agrees happily. Yeah, that's fun. But we just had a hurricane pass through and the waves are a bit biblical and dangerous. So you can't go out until later this week at least. The same goes for jet skiing. And when Mark asks about surf lessons... Like, Mark, come on now. You think that these other water sports are going to just be like, oh, well, the waves are choppy and horrible right now, but surfing's a great idea. No. Mm. No. And, hey, Armand, you are not helping things. I'm just saying, your customer service is customer sucking. So finally, Mark asks tersely, well, what do you suggest? And Armand does what he should have done in the beginning and offer an alternative. And he suggests they do some fun-filled snorkeling in the bay. The guys seem uninterested and until Armand adds, there's a family of sharks, small sharks, not a small family, that they can see this time of day. The father and son reluctantly agree and head off to get the gear at the beach shack. Once that business is done, Armand rounds the corner of the front desk only to step in Lonnie's water. But he doesn't know it's hers. He picks up a foot in disgust and cries, "What is this?" before calling over Dylan, a hotel attendant, to fetch a mop and clean up the mess.
Meanwhile, Rachel returns to her room where Shane is sitting contemplative on the couch. She tells him about the conversation with the teens and relays, "He made me feel very weird." Shane dismisses her statement and holds up his phone saying triumphantly, "That guy lied or he's stupid or something. We did book the pineapple suite. My mom forwarded me the booking." Rachel has had enough and raises her voice. "Shane, stop ruining our honeymoon. We have a perfectly good room here," he mutters. "But we paid for the pineapple suite." Rachel sinks into a chair across from him and mumbles, "Get over yourself." Shane looks at her incredulously and repeats, "Get over myself?" Rachel corrects, "Get over it. There's no problem." Shane's face breaks into a wide grin as he says, "Aw, Bubba, our first marital spat." She glares at him, confused. "Is that what you want? A fight?" He shakes his head and beckons her over, and she reluctantly slides next to him and sits there stiffly until he says, "I won't mention it again. I'll take care of it. I just want you to have the best." Rachel's face reads, "Bullshit, you want me to have the best or you want the best?" But says nothing and slowly puts her head on his shoulder.
Okay, bets on whether he will mention it again.
I would say 1,000 to 1 that he will.
Yes, I will agree with that.
Back at the spa, Tanya emerges and looks almost intoxicated with happiness. Belinda's back behind the counter trying to make an appointment for a client on the phone when Rachel saunters over and slides a $100 tip across the counter. Belinda mouths, "Thank you," and goes back to her conversation, but Tanya seems to need more recognition. She says quietly, not quietly, "I loved it." Belinda smiles and nods, straining to hear the call before Tanya smoothly slides another $100 across the desk. Belinda picks it up and mouths, "Really? Thank you," before making heart hands at Tanya, who finally throws open the spa doors and practically stumbles out.
Okay, for that day, Belinda is on the phone and she says, "Oh, yeah, I can get you in for a 3-hour massage and full treatment today. Today." She's a lying liar pants, and I want to know what the fuck is going on in this place because things are not right. Uh-huh. Is everybody on an acid trip and the entire place isn't real? Are all the workers AI? What? What is going on? I need to know. I need to know. I need to know.
Wow, I didn't even catch that. Corinne is on the case.
My spidey senses are a-tingling, and there is a lot not right going on here. A lot. That night, all the hotel guests attend the lobster bake. As the sun sinks down below the water surface, a native Hawaiian man blows into a conch. Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah. I got teary-eyed. Uh-huh.
Yeah. To announce that dinner is served, the guests all gather at the opulent outdoor dining area while Armand flits around checking in on everyone. He stops by the Mosbacher table where the Diva twins, the girls of family, are having a heated conversation about Hillary Clinton. So Armand addresses the men and asks, "How was snorkeling? Did you see little sharks?" Mark looks annoyed as he tells him, "Nope, we didn't see anything." he neglects to mention that Quinn actually saw his dad checking out his unit in the ocean because he's a little obsessed right now about his balls turning into grapefruits and being cancerous. Armand offers, "Well, take a little bread first thing in the morning and they'll swim right up to you like a Disney movie, a slightly scary Disney movie." Just then, young Dylan, the hotel attendant, pulls Armand away for a word. The manager seems put out until Dylan informs him, "Lonnie is giving birth in your office," to which Armand asks, "Who's Lonnie?" Dylan tells him, "It's the trainee whose first day was today." And Armand cannot wrap his head around this and argues, "That's not possible." To which Dylan coolly says, "Well, it's happening." Armand rushes towards the hotel with Dylan hot on his heels. But they don't get far before they are stopped by Tanya, who wants the manager to know what an unbelievable job Belinda did on her. Armand politely acknowledges the compliment and tries to sidestep the guest, but Tanya is relentless and adds, "And I have a treatment tomorrow and I want Belinda to do it. Can you make that happen?" Armand assures her he will make a note before rushing past. He goes straight to his office to find Lonnie splayed out on his couch, breathing heavily, flanked by two female co-workers who are holding her hands. Armand asks, "Why didn't you tell me you were pregnant?" Lonnie sobs, saying, "I'm sorry, I needed the work, and she's early, really early." One of the co-workers informs Armand that Dr. Rez is on his way, but he's coming from across the island, so Armand instructs Dylan to find Belinda because he thinks she looks like she's dabbled in midwifery, whatever that means.
Why? Why say that, Armand? Why? Why her? Why does she look like the one that was in midwifery?
Because she's a bit woo-woo and whatnot. Yes.
Back outside, the Mossbachers have split. Paula and Olivia are vaping out of sight and making eyes at a cute busser who's passing by, while Mom Mossbacher is tableside cutting up her 14-year-old son's lobster because it's tough, despite her son and husband's protests. Across the patio, Shane and Rachel sit across from each other while a German couple next to them speak in their native tongue. Shane leans slightly to hear a few words before telling his wife, "I bet those are the fuckers that got our room." She eyes him and he mutters, "It's okay, all right," before spotting Armand hurriedly walking past them. Shane stops him and pushes his phone towards the manager, explaining, "Excuse me, my mom sent me the booking confirmation and you did put us in the wrong room." Armand looks like he's about to lose it, but puts his finger up and asks a little shrilly, "Do you mind if I speak to you about this in a moment?" Shane relents but grumbles irritatedly as Armand hurries away. The manager finds Belinda and they cross back through the dining area only to pass Tanya, who sees the pair and calls out excitedly, "Belinda! Belinda, it's me! It's Tanya!" Oof. But the spa manager is too wrapped up in what Armand is telling her about the small matter of a woman giving birth to acknowledge her.
I have to wonder, does Rachel know that she's married to a serial killer? Because Shane is pathological, and I'm pretty sure he's got secrets hiding under that pasted-on smile of his. And I don't have a problem with him wanting to be charged accurately for the room he's in, but there's a time and a place, and my dude, over a lovely dinner with your new bride is not the time or the place.
I agree. On the other hand, like, he keeps getting put off by Armand, and he might be hard to find. Like, he might not be the kind that's always behind the desk. So if he's like, "Fuck it, there he is, I'm seeing him right now." I know time and place, but I'm also very impatient and sometimes have a scatterbrain. So if something's in front of me that I want to take care of, I'm like, "Oh, I got to do that now. I got to do it now. I got it."
Okay. So you're a Shane fan. I got you. It's fine.
Oh, bite your tongue. Bite. I am ashamed that you said that.
Oh! Well, I'm a Tanya you that I have a very different opinion, okay?
Okay. Oh, the wordplay is on. When they get back to the office, Belinda does prove useful and keeps Lonnie calm until the doctor arrives. Once Dr. Rez is on site, Armand leaves his office and guiltily admits to Dylan, "I just thought she was chunky the whole time that poor woman was giving birth, and I didn't even notice." His revelation is met by Lonnie screaming in pain behind the office's closed door, to which Armand responds plainly, "Fuck." Back in the hibiscus room after dinner, Tanya sees a small pamphlet that outlines some of the hotel staff and their services. She turns the page that has Belinda's pictures on it, reads it, and leaves it face up on her bedside while she gazes at the ceiling, smiling whimsically.
Wheat, wheat.
Obsessed much?
Ooh. I missed that scene. I'm glad that you caught it. And yeah, now I'm not feeling good vibes around this whole Belinda Tanya dynamic. Just saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the Tradewinds suite, Quinn is attempting to make his closet kitchen room comfortable, thunking around on his cot. And while Olivia grills her friend, "Did you think that employee was hot?" Paula feigns ignorance, which seems to incense Olivia because, for some reason, she doesn't like being gaslit by her friend. Go figure. While in the master suite, Mark Mossbacher's phone rings and he peers at the screen and hisses, "It's my doctor!" He picks it up, but while waiting, is asked by the nurse if she can call him back in a few minutes. She's lost the doctor's call, which almost sends Mark through the roof. Nicole tries to soothe his worries as he seems resigned to the fact that the news will be bad because the doctor is calling first thing in the morning. His time. I'm guessing they're East Coast. But her reassurances seem a little flat. I think she's just over her husband being a hypochondriac. but you know.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think I'd be a little, unless he's like this all the time, yeah. Like maybe he is like this all the time, but I'm like, you're at the same age your dad was when he died of cancer. I can kind of understand that you might be like, ah.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. In the palm suite, Rachel pounces on the bed wearing a very sexy negligee. She sits in front of her husband, who's reading, and says, "We're married and I'm happy." He puts his book down and gazes at her, saying, "I'm happy too." She hesitates before adding, "I hope that we don't become one of those old, depressing couples with all this baggage and resentment and regrets. I just hope it always stays this way." Stays this way? You've already been fighting because your husband is a giant dick. Like, stays what way?
Yeah, I know. I was like, oh, honey, you think it's going to get better or stay the same? It's only going to get worse.
It's like when Ainsley was like, he ruined my life. I'm like, did he though? Did Cash ruin your life from four weddings and a funeral? No. And you're not so happy right now. I'm just saying, you're already having to try and run interference for your like persnickety hubs. Shane puts down his book though and assures her it will stay this way, babe. Together forever. She crawls into his arms and he holds her and says, we will always be like this. We'll always be young. Really? We're always going to be young. Okay.
I know. Yeah. I was like, you know how aging works, right?
We're always going to be young and in love, and there will be days and days just like this. This is obviously what she wanted to hear, and she straddles him as the camera pans out, and he sexily flips her over onto her back, and we fade to black. The end of this episode. Woo!
So,
yes.
Can't do a dry kiss rating because it's the first of a series of, what, six?
Something like six. That. Yeah.
Yeah. But we can go over the four musketeers of diversity, yes. And how many musketeers were showing up to the table.
One musketeer, Belinda. She's black. Ta-da!
But she's also her and Lonnie. There's body diversity because her and Lonnie are not skinny minis.
100% body diversity. Two musketeers.
And then Paula also is not Caucasian. And they had some, Lonnie looked like she was native.
No, Lonnie looks like she's, yeah, native Hawaiian. Who's Paula?
Paula's Olivia's snarky friend.
Oh, yeah. No, 100%. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, but we have racial diversity and we have body diversity. So mm-hmm. We're still at two musketeers.
There is sexual diversity. Spoiler, it just hasn't reared its head yet.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Does that pineapple room really come into play?
And there is no disability representation.
Correct.
Well, right. No, none there. So, Corinne.
Yes.
I would love you to hypothesize what you think is going to happen next. What is going on? What's below the surface at the White Lotus?
Okay. Here is my fantastical story. Armand is not actually a manager of a hotel because he's completely incompetent at it. He is instead a spy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's totally a spy. And Belinda... Okay, Belinda, please, motherfucker. She is, like, ayahuasca-ing the fuck out of, like, the entire hotel or something at some point in time. Everybody's just going to end up going on a non-consensual acid trip or something because Belinda, she's, like, poisoning somebody. She's, like, she's doing something. I have no trust for Belinda. She's a lying liar pants. She's got her fire pants on. I'm going to guess that at some point... Connie Britton, whatever her name is.
Oh, that's Nicole Mossbacher. Nicole.
Thank you. That Nicole, she is so sleeping with Shane at some point. Yep, that's happening. I'm telling you.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's an interesting prediction there. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Everybody's room turns into the pineapple rooms and everybody sleeps with everybody else.
Look, she's sexually frustrated AF. The Diva Twins, they... divorce at some point because of bestie betrayal. There's bestie betrayal happening amongst the Diva Twins.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Quinn, yep. The son, he's going to figure out what the fuck is going on here because Quinn is stealthy. He's got, and maybe Olivia will like come through as a decent human being. Dad isn't dying. He's going to be okay. But who knows? He might be the one in the box. Who knows?
What are your predictions for Tanya?
Tanya is like her own island of just humanity.
It'd be really fun if she was a serial killer.
Yeah. I think that she is unhealthily obsessed with Belinda, and that, you know, she may single white female her.
Mm.
Yes. And then our final person. Well, I mean, we have Lonnie, who is giving birth to a child. We're just going to leave that one there. And we have our friend, the news reporter who's married to Shane. What's her name?
Rachel.
Then we have Rachel. And as I said earlier, I think that Rachel has ulterior motives. I think that she fucking kind of manipulated Shane into going to this resort specifically. And she has a plan to expose something. And also, she did a marriage of convenience to Shane because she's a little in over her head financially. And she's just like, you know what? I think I can work the system here. And I think it's going to work out. And so she's like kind of sneaky, but like also okay. But I think that she's going to end up even sneakier. We're going to see what happens.
We are.
Yes.
We're definitely going to see what happens.
Mm-hmm. So those are my thoughts.
Corinne's thoughts on White Lotus or Pink Chrysanthemum or Yellow Peony.
Mm-hmm. And Tam, I know this needs to be broad strokes here, but how accurate am I?
slightly, but only in little bits and pieces.
Uh-huh. It's going to come together. It's going to come together. I'm going to get that red string. I'm going to put it all together. I've got my murder board out. It's ready.
Yeah, I was like, oh, yeah, no, not that either. No, no, no. The whole time you were talking. Oh, wait, no, but yeah, Lonnie is pregnant and having a baby. There, you got that one.
Yeah. Yes, we already knew that. Yes. So anyways, I liked my hypotheses, though, and I am looking forward to seeing what happens in our next episode. So, Tam, what do we have coming up next episode?
Another episode of White Lotus. We will find out more about what plagues Armand behind that cheery facade. Mm. We will find out what Rachel's ulterior motives actually are. Mm. We will find out if Olivia and Paul are besties till the end. And of course, if Mark Mosbacher really does have testicular cancer or if he's just got an enlarged ball sack.
Which it didn't even look enlarged when I rolled it back and looked at it. I know it looked enlarged twice, to you because you were watching it on a very large screen. But I was just like, I have seen bigger balls than that. So,
yeah, I was like, just the huge testicles on my screen that are like 2 feet tall.
That's what you get for having a big screen TV. Okay, Tam? So, if you have anything that you'd like to say about the relationship dynamics in White...
You can do it.
Lotus?
Yes. Yes, Corinne. Yes. White Lotus. It's White Lotus.
I was like, Black Dahlia? No, that's not the right thing.
Oh, Lord. Here we go again.
White Lotus, you can reach out to us at onedrykiss@gmail.com or DM us on Insta or Facebook, all at onedrykiss.
And that's one spelled O-N-E. And as always, if you can find the time to rate and review us anywhere you listen to this podcast, we'd greatly appreciate it. But in the meantime, we'll thank you for stopping by and we'll bid you adieu with one dry kiss. Mwah! See you next time.
See you next time.
See you next time. Are you recording on the Zoom call?
Oh, shit. Fuck. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
What would I do without you? Sweet Jesus. I don't know what you're talking about. Of course I was recording. I was recording all along.
That's the lady was just on a delay. That's all.
Yeah. Yeah. Just really long delay. Like the delay in labor between me and my sister, the twins. New phone, who dis?
Oh, yes. New phone, who dis? Yes. Works in so many situations.
Seriously.